magic of the directional coupler is that the signal being picked up by the coupled line has directivity. That is to say, for the signal flowing forward on the main line, the signal being picked up by the coupled line is in a particular direction only, if it's well designed. And now, if in the reverse direction it goes into a dummy load, you never see that signal again. And on the coupled line, usually the coupled line, on one of its two terminals, there is a dummy load. On the other one is the output power detecting device. And therefore, if you make the mistake of taking a very high standing wave rate, a very high performance, low standing wave ratio antenna, and now you put in a huge ratio of slug to measure forward and reverse power, when you're using that 3-watt slug to measure the reverse power, and you think it's going to ignore the 3,000 watts of forward power, a fraction of that 3,000 watts of forward power is going into that dummy load that's inside of that slug that you don't know about, and you're going to burn it up. Let me drop it. The bottom line of all of this is that if you're using a lower power slug to try to get greater resolution of reverse power, I wouldn't push your luck using that technique by more than maybe a 10-to-1 ratio. Maybe I would use, instead of a 300-watt slug forward, I'd use to measure the reverse power, I'd use a 3-kilowatt slug to measure forward. In this example, I'd use a 300-watt slug to measure the reverse. I wouldn't go down to a 3-watt slug. You're most likely going to burn it up, if you know what I mean. So every directional coupler really picks up signals in both directions. Just one of those directions, you terminate the signal, and the other direction, you sense that signal. And you can't stop that phenomenon from happening. And if that termination is not built for high enough power, you're going to burn it up. And inside of that tiny slug, you can't put a 10-watt termination in there. KC2WGB, K2RW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good. I'm sure that eased his mind. So he's okay with the 100-watt slug. But, I don't believe in using the lower slugs because they are not that durable. Directional couplers are a little different. It's very difficult to damage them. You really got to do a Herculean job to damage those boys. But the bird slugs, yeah, you can blow them easily. Okay, let me let it drop. I'll go on to the last one. There it is. All right, now I got a young scientist with a question. This is a good one. He's working with colors in water and the absorption rate of heat. Okay, let me describe the setup. He's got 250 milliliter cube that he fills with water, ambient temperature, okay, and he heats it up with this little quartz lamp, and he notices the rise over time, a rise of temperature over time. Then he lets everything acclimate to the ambient temperatures again, and he adds dye, sometimes red, sometimes green, sometimes blue, and he watches the temperature rise with the different colors, and they're different, and he's been able to measure that. His question is, what's going on? Is it the colored molecules of the dye that are absorbing the heat and traveling and causing the vibration, or is that color permeating the molecules of water also and causing the water element to get excited? How is that actually coupling to the overall temperature of the liquid, Dick? If you got some information on that, back to you. KC2WGB.
I might not have information on this. However, I know that I have used over the years these various films, I'm going to call them. You can buy various films that are coated with certain kinds of chemistry that when you exceed a certain temperature, the film will change color. And in some cases, it changes the color permanently. In some cases, it changes the color only during the temperature excursion. So there's all kinds of fancy chemistry that is designed to change color as a function of temperature. Is there a natural phenomena. In other words, if I put various crystals of things that I can dissolve in water, is there a clearly defined characteristic where the light goes through there in different ways at different temperatures? That might be, I don't know. If he wants to use chemistry in the water as a temperature sensor, in general, that's a very coarse sensing characteristic. A really good thermocouple, a really good thermometer. And there are kinds of thermocouple, thermometer-like things where the actual sensor at the end of the two wires is something that's only a millimeter square, millimeter cube, if you want to, or even smaller. So for you to be able to sense how hot is the water at the bottom of the flask, the middle of the flask, the top of the flask, the left-hand corner, and so on, directly measuring temperature, I think it's easier to do than to do it with changing colors of chemistry you put in there. But that's one way of doing it. Let me drop. The good news is about the right kind of chemistry is that convection can be taking place and you'll watch the swirling of the colored materials. What's really going on here is calorimetry. If your container of water, which is a beautiful dummy load for a thermal measurement, if that dummy load of 250 milliliters of water is in a foam box, and the right kind of foam has got some extremely high R factor, very good insulation. If your water is well enough insulated to the outside world so that the thermal time constant of the water to the universe becomes a very long number, like hours, you now can do some very specific energy measurements. For instance, if you took that foam box, assuming the foam doesn't respond to microwaves, but the water definitely does, and you put that container of water with the foam inside your microwave oven, and you've got some kind of a temperature measuring device inside of the water, and now you measure, you run your microwave oven at full blast, half power, quarter power, 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes. I mean, after a certain number of minutes of running your microwave oven, the thermal change, the water might start off at 25 degrees centigrade and ends up at 75 degrees centigrade after 2 minutes of running. And you go through the calculation, you may find out, my particular microwave oven, by that calorimetry measurement, I have just confirmed it is really generating 731 watts of power, of radio power, that was being absorbed by the water. And water, by the way, at microwave frequencies becomes an extremely high efficient dummy load. Even though you don't see the coupling coefficient, believe me, it's there. Because of the way, let me drop it. Because the microwave oven is such a highly reflective, very well shielded box, any of the energy that's emitted by the magnetron tube that doesn't get directly absorbed by the water, if some of it, if the water is absorbing 75% of it and 25% of it's reflected, you're about to ask, where does the 25% go? It reflects off the floor, walls, and ceiling of your microwave oven and gets another chance to go back to the water and get absorbed again. A little bit of it goes back to the magnetron tube, but that's minor. So of all the energy you put into that microwave oven, an extremely high percentage of it gets absorbed by the food, because that's the only lossy substance in there. Which, by the way, gave me a very funny feeling once when I was in a very highly shielded screen room at Airborne Instruments Laboratory. We were testing a high power transmitter. Let me drop. The high power transmitter went through a piece of flexible waveguide, double ridge flexible waveguide. And because the power out of the transmitter was supposed to be running in the pulse mode, and because of a software error that occurred, the transmitter was running in the continuous mode. Therefore, the dummy load, which was rated for zillions of watts, got overheated. It melted the high temperature solder joint where the waveguide, flexible waveguide, went into the microwave dummy load. The piece of waveguide broke away and flopped down to the floor. And the reason we found out about it is because a spectrum analyzer in the other end of the room was running and nothing was connected to the front panel. And a technician looked at the screen of the spectrum analyzer and he saw a signal go to the top of the screen. He says, that doesn't look right. He ran over to the wall immediately and hit the great big red panic button and turned it off. Well, with a whole bunch of investigation, we found out that the transmitter had run in that mode for something like 10 minutes. And now you ask yourself, that high power transmitter with the open-ended piece of waveguide, which is an extremely good antenna, is squirting zillions of watts into that room, and the room is a very well-shielded room. and what in the room is absorptive? Human beings. Nothing else. All of that power coming out of that transmitter was being bounced off the walls as if it was the world's biggest microwave oven, and it was going into the humans. Well, when you go through the calculations of how big was the room, how many human beings, how many feet away, normal antenna patterns, free space loss, and whatever, we came to the conclusion nobody got more than a few milliwatts of power absorbed into portions of their body. And to be on the safe side, all the people who were in that room at that time got free eye examinations every single year to make sure they weren't developing cataracts or whatever. So as you can tell, calorimetry with water, and human beings, by the way, are more water than anything else.
Repeater, time out.
So I had done some calculations as to how much exposure the human beings were really going to get. And I decided I was going to confirm it. I picked up a radiation hazard meter, and I walked through the door of that room when I told them to turn on the transmitter again, and I watched the needle as they walked into the room. And so they got mad at me for doing that. But I was able to confirm that nobody had a bad exposure because nobody was close to that piece of waveguide. If somebody was standing alongside of that piece of waveguide for the 10 minutes that it ran, yes, that could have been a little bit dicey. And they added all kinds of safety structures to that room after that to make sure this couldn't happen again. So he's into some beautiful calorimetry experiment here. The heating of water and the temperature you measure with a thermometer is a great way to go. Doing it with chemistry is a tough way to go because it gives you a kind of a coarse measurement. But if you want to be able to see the convective currents taking place with water being heated, that would be kind of fun to do with chemistry. And you can buy, let me drop it. I know you can buy specific chemicals and you can buy specific film that are coated with the chemical, and sometimes there may be in a waterproof film, so that you can sink these pieces of film with temperature sensing chemistry in them into the water and tape them down so that they stay in certain positions inside your flask, and therefore by the change in color of the film, which is a temperature sensing device, you can find out what's going on in your water. So there's all kinds of ways you can do some interesting calorimetry experiments with that methodology that he is now experimenting with, as I see it, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet.
All right, Dick, very good. Basically, what he's doing is exposing it to the light for a specific amount of time, and then he stirs it and measures it with his thermometer, and he just noticed that difference in the different colored water and liquids, and he was wondering what was actually being activated. Is it both? Are the water molecules traveling faster because of the collision with the heated colored element? So I thought it was an interesting question, but he's on his way to having some fun here. But very good. That's it from the mailbag. So let's go over to Paul and see what adventure he's going to take us on. And thanks for the question, everybody, and we'll be back. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, I'm going to add a couple more words to what we just discussed, John, and that is water at room temperature, air at room temperature, has a very finite, very calculatable average speed of the molecules. Air at room temperature, the vast majority of those air molecules are moving at 500 meters per second. Average speed. Some of them a little faster, some of them a little bit slower because they're bouncing against each other in ways that are co-phase and antiphase, if you know what I mean. So there's a Gaussian distribution of temperature, which really is a Gaussian distribution of speed of those air molecules. By the way, 500 meters per second is roughly 1.5 times the speed of sound. That's crazy. The individual molecules of the air in the room you're in right now, the average speed of them is 1.5 times the speed of sound. Rough number. Kind of funny. And now the air in the bottom of your bicycle pump, when you push down on the plunger, gets heated by what I call the ping pong paddle effect. You guys have heard about that lots of times. And those air molecules in the bottom of the pump are at maybe 1,000 meters per second instead of 500 meters per second because you've heated them up. And that, by the way, would be four times the absolute temperature. Temperature is a measure of average kinetic energy due to speed. So what we thermometer. We call it temperature. What is it really? It is the speed of the molecules. Even if it's a solid, the molecules still have that speed. They're jiggling in space as if they're all mounted on a bunch of springs. But that's what temperature is. Kinetic energy of molecules. The vast majority of it is translational kinetic energy. If it's a solid, they're shaking in space, in place. If it's a liquid or a gas, they're repeater.
Time out.
As I was saying, if it's a liquid or a gas, they're really moving. So, whatever is the temperature of the water in the lower cubic centimeter, the upper cubic centimeter, the middle cubic centimeter of your container, your thermometer tells you what we call temperature. That really is how fast are they moving. And so, just because the water molecules are at that temperature and moving more rapidly, and they also expand a little bit. And by the way, there's another peculiar characteristic of water. Let me drop it. As you dig deeper and deeper, you'll find out there's a significant amount of evidence that a lot of global warming is taking place, and it appears that mankind's operations, putting carbon dioxide, methane, whatever, into the air by our operations, we are increasing the global warming. There's a lot of evidence of that. The global warming, in turn, is making the average temperature of the seawater around the world higher. Therefore, the sea level is rising. Is the sea level rising because the ice at the poles is melting and Greenland ice is melting? That may be, I don't know the exact number, but that may be 20% of the cause. The majority of the sea level rise is because when you heat water, it expands. It doesn't expand a whole lot, but it expands. But that water is expanding all the way down to the depths of that ocean. So as the average temperature of the ocean rises, the water in the ocean slightly expands, and the sea level and the places that have very low land are going to start becoming flooded, and there's evidence of that taking place. The ice that melts at the North Pole, for instance, does that really raise the sea level? Not necessarily. As you could take a glass of water, let me drop it.
The land ice stick.
Yeah, I'm going to get to that for a second. You can start off with a glass of water filled to the absolute top with an ice cube floating in the top of the water. And you ask a person, what's going to happen as the ice cube melts? Will the water overflow? And the answer is no, it does not. The change in temperature, the change in expansion, and so on, the water doesn't overflow as the ice cube melts. So the North Pole, where an awful lot of the ice is floating, the water that melts doesn't change the level of the seawater. It just changes a certain amount of material that is floating in that seawater. Now, in the case of the South Pole, where a lot of that ice is on land, you and I think that land is steady. When it comes to the huge number of zillions of pounds of ice that's on that land, if you melted that ice, you think the land is going to stay at the same level? Not at all. You wait long enough, that magma, there's a flowing fluid of Earth-like materials X number of miles down, and everything that you call land is really floating. The plate tectonics, those individual plates are moving around because they're on a floating substance. So as you melt the snow, as you melt the ice on the South Pole, is all that water going into raising the sea level? Not necessarily. You're going to be removing some of the weight of the ice on that land, and that land will, at some period of time, float higher on that magma that's below it. So melting the ice itself is not necessarily going to be the major cause of sea level rising. Let me drop this. The expansion of hotter seawater is the major cause of sea level rising. There's a few articles that say that, and I think they could very well be accurate. Paul, one of the things that you and I were discussing during the week a little bit was the fact that there's proposals to make a robot that's eventually going to go out there and repair our synchronous satellite, to bring a satellite, our synchronous satellite, back down and refurbish it out of the question. You've made a huge investment to put it where it is. And if it's in good shape, continue to use where it is and go out there and put some new fuel into it. WS2N with the space report number 199. Next week, your odometer is going to switch over, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW, the TechNet.
Yeah, I see that. We'll be at 200 next week.
nowhere that one website that you sent me showing the complications involved with the robot actually working on a satellite that was from Dauber. And I think they, you know, the defense agency, I think Dauber's got a long way to go. But there are a couple of other ones. I think I might have sent you that. There's two being considered, one by Orbital ATK and one by MDA. MDA Corporation is the one corporation that's very good in robotics. They built the robotic arm for the space shuttle and Canadarm2 for the International Space Station. But one of the proposals is for Orbital ATK to actually have a satellite go up and attach itself to another satellite, you know, an existing geosegmented satellite. And then once it's attached, the fuel on board that this new satellite brought with it will stay attached to the spacecraft and move it around wherever it wants to go. That's one choice that SES is involved with. SES is the biggest satellite operating company in the world. They operate out of Luxembourg. They've got over 50 operational geosynchronous satellites. So they would like to have that system. In fact, any of the future satellites that are being built are going to have this attachment permanently attached to the satellite, so they'll be ready to do that. The other choice is by MDA from Canada, the robotic company, and they plan on sending a satellite up and being able to refuel that satellite and then go on and maybe move to another satellite, do the same thing. So two possibilities that they're working on. Let me drop it. We'll see what happens. But let me start from... usually I make an announcement about different rockets that are going to be going off at the end of that. But today, let me just mention this one by SpaceX. They're going to be sending a Falcon 9 up, carrying a Japanese satellite to geosynchronous orbit. It's called the JC-SAT, you know, for Japan Communication Satellite. It's a satellite that will be used for television, it'll be used for communications, even Wi-Fi, and different mobile-to-mobile applications. But nevertheless, it's going to go to geosynchronous orbit by a Falcon 9 rocket launched from Cape Canaveral. And again, SpaceX is going to try to land its booster, first stage booster, on a drone ship, a barge, probably about 400 miles out on the Atlantic. The last time they did it on April 2nd was about 210 miles out. So it's a little further. It's a much more difficult attempt. The last one, they were going about 4,000 miles per hour when they detached from the second stage. And they'll probably be going about twice that speed. They'll also be higher up and further down downrange. So the margin of fuel that will be left will be very marginal. They'll be trying to also land that booster on a platform. They did that two flights ago. Not the last one succeeded. That they were sending up to the space station. That's when they bought the Bigelow expandable module up to. That one, they succeeded in saving the booster. One previous to that, they did not. It crashed on the drone ship. And it might happen again this time, but he's getting better at it each time. And the long-term goal is to be able to utilize these drone ships. Because, on some flights, Low Earth orbit flights, he plans on bringing boosters back to Florida directly, and eventually, when launched out of California, bring them back to Vandenberg Air Force Base. But on long-term flights, long distance flights like the geosynchronous one. Plans on landing them on the drones. I thought I had mentioned that. Another company that I haven't talked about in probably a couple of years is this company, it's a Vulcan, that's the name of the company, but it's run by this Paul Allen. They're building the Stratolaunch, lift vehicle. Stratolaunch is going to be the world's biggest airplane, really. And two fuselages with one longest wingspan, I mean, much longer than a football field there. Give you an idea, the ISS is about a little longer than a football field. It'll be about that length, about the same length as the International Space Station. And this thing will be a carrier plane. It'll take up rockets, you know, bring it up to 40,000 feet up, and it'll drop it, and they plan on using that to put rockets and payloads into space. And it's so big that eventually they actually have a long-term plan of putting a two-person crew on one of these rockets. But for now, they've been building this for years. He probably started about 7-8 years ago, and he's to the point now where within probably a year and a half, he'll be able to test flight this airplane. Let me drop it. One is he comes out of a Microsoft world. He was involved with Bill Gates, but he's got his own company doing this now, and we'll see how that goes. All right, let's see. There's so many other topics that I could tell you about China, how they're doing, but I really wanted to tell you, foreign launches are important, but I wanted to tell you about Russia. I talked about this probably a couple of weeks in a row. They got a successful launch out of their new launch facility, Vostochny, in far eastern Russia. They have a couple of spaceports in Russia, but nothing on the far east. They always wanted to set one up there. This Vostochny is eventually going to be so big, it'll be eventually, many years from now probably, but a town of around 40,000 people. They'll have all kinds of facilities, but right now it's on the small side. But they did finally launch a Soyuz rocket from there. About a week ago. So it was successful. They sent it on a polar flight, and it was a Soyuz rocket, very similar to or the same type that they've launched from Kazakhstan, from Baikonur launch complex. Probably almost 2,000 different times. Let me drop it. So their $3 billion launch facility is finally complete after probably about 10, 15 years of working on this thing. And they eventually will have more launch pads built on it. So they'll be sending people from there, either on the Soyuz, but most likely on the new Angara. They have an Angara type of rocket that they've been working on. They've test flown it already, and Angara is their rocket that will eventually succeed all the Soyuz rockets in the future. So that'll probably first launch in 2019. Let me drop it. Let's see the. I hate to get to astronomy because, anything to do with astronomy, you really should go to Craig on the astronomy net. But I had to mention this one because it is a Hubble discovery with their wide field camera 3 that they have on board Hubble. They discovered another moon going around the dwarf planet. This one was discovered a couple of years ago, but it's called Maki Maki. It's actually spelled M-A-K-E, M-A-K-E. But this multiple units. This one is about 45 AU. So, but it's interesting to note that the Hubble operating all these decades later. Back, they started in 1990, and here it is still making discovery. All six gyroscopes are still operating, and they're good to go. There's so many other topics. I just had one more, and it's the one that's been on all the space reports this week. Is SpaceX has decided that they're going to launch a Dragon unmanned. Let me drop it. WS2N to Mars in 2018. So, good thing is, NASA's not really involved with it. They're going to do this on their own. NASA is involved to the extent they'll utilize the deep space network for communications. They're going to exchange all science information with SpaceX regarding the entry and landing of the Dragon spacecraft. They plan on doing it without parachutes. It's got a heat shield. It's got propulsion rockets, and it's quite heavy. It'll be quite an accomplishment. The heaviest thing that we've landed on Mars so far, NASA has landed the Curiosity rover, and that's about 2,000 pounds. This thing is about six times heavier to launch a big spacecraft like this and land on Mars. So you're looking at this 12,000 pound spacecraft. So we'll see how that works out 2 years from now, 2018. And Elon Musk made the announcement, and NASA also talked about it. So it kind of confirmed that. Back to you, Dick. There's more things. I'm not going to cover it, though. We'll just. Enough is enough. K2RIW, WS2N.
The spacecraft that he's going to send to Mars, is the very first one he sends there going to land or just loop around Mars? Remember in the beginning of the Apollo program, the very first time mankind went to the moon, on Apollo 8, they just did a figure 8 around the moon, went into lunar orbit, and then came back home. And it was until Apollo 11 that they finally landed. So is Musk going to be doing something similar with Mars? Or the first time he brings a spacecraft to Mars, is it going to be a lander? And the next step up on Curiosity, where they're going to be building a super larger Curiosity, I guess he said six times heavier, with a lot more instrumentation on board, and I believe the majority of instrumentation is going to be there looking for life, doing a more thorough study of past life events that may have existed on Mars. Back to you for some comments on those, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, I might have blurred some of the topics together. I'm sorry for doing that, but NASA has Curiosity that weighs roughly 2,000 pounds, much bigger than Spirit and Opportunity. Those things only weighed about 450 pounds. It is a 2,000-pound thing. The next rover that NASA sends will be very similar to Curiosity, except much more advanced detectors on board, but very similar. And very similar in weight, a little over 2,000 pounds. So that's NASA's end of it. Now, SpaceX, independent of NASA, is going to be sending the. It's a crewed, when I say crewed, C-R-E-W, but a crewed spacecraft. It's called, his spacecraft are all called the Dragon. Got the Dragon cargo version, which has been going up to the International Space Station. Then he's gonna have the Dragon crew version, which is gonna be launched within about a year to the International Space Station with people on it. It'll start off with two people, and eventually four astronauts will be going up at a time. Then he has some. something called the Red Dragon. Drop it. The Red Dragon will be equivalent to a crewed vehicle. The only difference is it will be going to Mars. It will be a lander. It's going to have a heat shield similar to the Piker heat shields that we have, that he's using here on Earth to bring the Dragon back. He does that from the International Space Station. But this is, we'll also have feet that are going to come out at the last minute, 4 feet from the bottom of the heat shield right before it lands. And it will do a propulsive landing all the way down. So it's got a heat shield, no parachute, and he's got Super Draco engines, they're called. He's going to have 8 of these engines located in 4 different places around the spacecraft, and he's got 2 in each location, so that's 8. Each one, I think, has the capability of, total amount, I think, is 150,000 pounds of thrust or something like that. Each one is, I think, 16,000 pounds of thrust. So that's the deal. It's going to be similar to a crew. If you had people in it, it would work, except they wouldn't be able to come back. Back to you, Dick.
So he's going to send something that is capable of carrying a crew. That means it's got some volume, some lift capability. It's going to be brought down to the surface by rocket power, not by parachute. And therefore, in theory, a crew could be there and be on the surface of Mars. But, and it sounds to me like that's a small number of years away that he's planning to do this as a demonstration. But to put human beings on Mars, you know my opinion on that one, to supply them enough food, water, and air for an extended period of time is a serious difficulty. And we went to the moon because we were in competition with the Soviet Union. It's one of the major reasons we did it. We don't have that competition when it comes to going to Mars. And when it comes to all of the scientific measurements, something like Curiosity can measure for you. Let me drop it. Curiosity can do it 24/7, years on end. A human being in that location, do you get enough in return? You get some additional information. He's got adaptability. He can sit there and sift the soil through his hand and look for the funny-looking crystals and so on. Without a doubt, a human being will find things that that Curiosity might not find. But the number of dollars and the amount of risk to life and limb it takes to get a man there, the amount of resources required to maintain him there, the resources required to get him back home, and the huge amount of radiation exposure for years on end getting there and coming back home, the chances of getting that guy back alive, or that crew back alive, I think is not very good. So when it comes to Musk doing this demonstration that he can put hardware on Mars, beautiful. But it sounds like he's moving in the direction of proving he can put people on Mars, and there I'm becoming skeptical, as you know. WSUN, K2RIW.
This is WSUN. I know Elon Musk, he's got all these three big companies. He's got SpaceX, and then he has Tesla, multi-billion-dollar operation. He has SolarCity, putting in all these solar panels all over the country. But his main goal, he's all about Mars. As far as he's concerned, he would go to Mars if he could. So, that's his long-term goal. And whether he ever does it or not, who knows. But he's going to try. And he's got a lot of money. He knows it's going to be very expensive. He says, without the ability to reuse spacecraft, the reusable boosters, eventually reusable second stages, he knows throwing this stuff away is very expensive. He could bring the price down. He feels in the long run, 100-to-1 ratio. And once he gets it to that point, he'd be able to send all the vehicles that he needed to Mars, he'd be able to have a spacecraft in orbit around Mars that would act as a return vehicle for a crew. He's got long-term plans of building a bigger rocket, at least three times bigger than the Falcon 9, you know, that he plans on sending all this stuff to Mars eventually, many years down the road. But he wants to show that he can do it. We'll see. He's got the ability to land big vehicles on Earth.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
He's tested these rockets out, these Super Dracos, before. I've seen them in a test. He launched from Cape Canaveral on one of these, just using these rockets, and wound up a mile or two out in the sea with the parachute. Let me drop it. They worked flawlessly, and the idea of these rockets have two purposes. One, to either land, well, really three purposes. In this case, he plans on landing on Mars. He can use also the Super Dracos. Eventually, he plans on deorbiting Earth with crew and landing on land, all propulsive engines using the exact same Draco, Super Draco engines. And the other main purpose of these engines are an abort system. You'll notice on the top of the Falcon 9, when eventually they have a crew, they won't have a tractor rocket launch abort system. He's going to have a pusher system. So let's say he goes up and he's a couple of miles in the air, and there's a problem with the booster, which he had on one of the CRS-7 missions when they was bringing supplies up to the space station, and the thing blew up. In that case, the crewed vehicle would be saved. It would separate from that disaster with these Super Draco engines and parachute back to the ocean. Back to you, Dick.
The movie The Martian gives us an extremely unrealistic view of what Mars is like. In reality, Mars is at some ridiculously cold temperature, like minus 100 degrees Fahrenheit, might be the average. And you see this guy with a spacesuit and a helmet, and he's traveling across Mars and resting during the day, or traveling at night and resting during the day and charging his solar cells on his vehicle and laying out there in the sun as if he's in the California seaside, if you know what I mean. Very unrealistic. So the real temperatures of Mars are so darn cold most of the time. That represents a huge energy requirement in order to keep the human beings there from freezing. I mean, 1,000 times easier than landing a man on Mars is landing a man on the moon. Roughly 1,000 times easier. To colonize the moon would be ridiculously difficult because every one of those lunar landings were carefully engineered to land on the portion of the moon was near sunrise or near sunset. The moon goes to some number like 150 degrees Celsius in the daytime, which is way beyond boiling water, and minus 150 degrees at nighttime. I don't know the exact numbers, but it gets extremely hot and extremely cold. So without having a habitation facility that's 100 meters below the surface, you can't tolerate the temperature there. And Mars has got these ridiculously cold temperatures. So where's all the energy going to come from to supply the heat to keep the astronauts from freezing, as well as food, air, and water, and living in spacesuits? There's a whole lot of details that make it very difficult. So this crew of bull craft that he's going to land on Mars, what year is he doing that? Is it like the year 2018 or 2020? As a demonstration over you both, WS2N, K2RIW?
SpaceX has plans for 2018. They plan on doing it during that year because you have a Mars alignment with Earth roughly a little over every 2 years, or roughly 2 years. So if he doesn't make that, he'll shoot for the 2020 window. It'll be launched on a combination of rockets that haven't been launched before. It'll be launched on the Falcon Heavy, they call it, the Falcon Heavy. Instead of having 9 rockets to launch from Earth, it'll be 27 rockets. You'll have essentially 3 Falcon 9s bolted together. The center Falcon 9 will be a true Falcon 9. It'll have the 10th rocket, the Merlin D rocket is used for the second stage. This way it uses the same fuel as the rest of the rocket. It simplifies things, and that's what he's been using. So it'll have the Merlin D vacuum rated rocket for a second stage on top of the middle one, but the other two will be essentially boosters. All 3 boosters will be planned on returning back to either Cape Canaveral or back to the drone ships out in the ocean. Long-term plans, he's got so many rockets on his manifest. There's going to be more coming up to launch, that he's building a new launch facility, just like Russia needed another one. SpaceX needs one. He's been building it for quite a few years down in Texas.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
I expected that to be up and running by now, but he had some problems. That facility, the ground wasn't as stable as he needed, so he's bringing in almost 400,000 truckloads of dirt. Even as we speak, this has been going on for a couple of years. We'll probably continue for another year. And it's in as much dirt as they said. They gave some comparison how much dirt this is. But they need to stabilize the ground before he can actually build a complex. And that's where he plans on eventually launching rockets and eventually the Mars Colonial rocket will eventually be launched from there. They call it the Mars Colonial Transport. And that's the one that's going to be probably about 3 times larger than diameter-wise of the Falcon 9. The Falcon 9 is about 12 feet in diameter, so it's going to be about 3 times bigger in diameter, with much bigger rockets, of course. So, I mean, I'm talking about his long-term plans, but is he building the facilities for it? Yeah, down in Texas, right on the Mexico-Texas border. You'll see rockets launch from there probably as early as 2019, I would think. Back to you, Dick.
He's doing an awful lot. Where is his financing coming from? A lot of the vehicles he's building are launching cargo for NASA. So he's getting a lot of funding for NASA. But his operation sounds economically like it's way with his future plans. Way beyond what his NASA funding is going to support. Is he building vehicles to sell to European and Asian nations? Where do you think all of his financing to do all this is coming from, Paul? These future plans sound very expensive, particularly the bucks involved for landing something on Mars, a crewable structure on Mars. So does he make it clear that he's got the cash flow? Are people making contributions to him as if he's a political organization? Over to you, Paul, KQRIW.
Yeah, there's no crowdfunding involved with this guy. He comes out of PayPal. PayPal, he started years ago, and that's where he got a whole bunch of money. He sold that company, sold his end of it, to launched three rockets, and they failed, and he was running out of money real quick. Now, at that time, his goal was, again, to eventually get a rocket to Mars. So he launches a fourth one, and his Falcon 1 rocket gets into space, into orbit. And it was a success. Right away, NASA gave him seed money to continue. And inside of no time, he's got the Falcon 9 built. And he starts launching rockets for NASA. But soon after that, he starts sending rockets to geosynchronous orbit. He's launched a couple for SES, the one I mentioned earlier, biggest satellite company in the world. He's launched rockets for, I think, one big one for Thailand. I think he's up to his 22nd flight. I can't name them all, but 22nd or 23rd flight. But a lot of geosynchronous flights. And I'm sure of NASA's billions of dollars, but he's also getting, hundreds of millions of dollars for every flight he launches. Like this week, he's going to launch one for Japan. I don't know, maybe he'll get $300-400 billion for that. Let me drop it. So I think I figured it out one time. NASA's going to be about one-third of the money compared to maybe even less compared to all these other rockets that he's got planned. I mean, a lot of them are going to be for the defense. It's legal now for him to launch rockets for the Air Force. He just signed a contract with them. And these things probably go into the $500 million numbers. So, it's become self-supporting, the rocket industry. On top of everything, he's got the Tesla company building the electric cars. Solar City putting solar panels all over the country. Maybe all over the world, for all I know. So that's where he's coming from. And I don't even think he's as rich as the guy from Blue Origin. Jeff Bezos, let me drop it. Which, he's up and coming. He's launching suborbital flights so far. And I think he's up to 30. He's going to try a fourth one where he launches the same rocket and comes back, launches the exact same rocket and comes back. They're suborbital. But eventually, he's got plans on launching from Florida, too. He took over a launch complex, 36A. So that's Blue Origins. So let's see how far he goes. This guy's got more money, I think, than Elon. They just rated him the fourth richest guy in the world. He's up to $60 billion. And I don't think he's made 10 cents on rockets. He's Amazon. He owns Amazon. Back to you, Dick.
Amazing. I'm pretty sure you said it, but I got called away and I'm missing one piece of information. With Elon Musk's current plans, he's going to put a piece of hardware, maybe a crewable piece of hardware, on the surface of Mars, roughly what year? He's planning to do that what year, Apollo, go ahead.
2 years from now, so that's the next window. A lot of stuff going to Mars 2 years from now. China plans on sending something. They plan on sending an orbiter and a rover in one mission. You've got Roscosmos, that's, Russia, they're launching a proton rocket with an ESA, European Space Agency rover on board. That'll be 2018 as well. And in fact, the United States, NASA's going to launch the InSight mission, not a rover, but that's going to detect Mars quakes and tell you all about the inside of Mars. When that gets there, that was supposed to launch this year, but that, because of a Kinesis, that's Kinesis, the French Space Agency. They had a problem with one of the detectors that they were building for NASA. They canceled that for this window, and they'll make it for 2018. So Elon Musk is going to join that group and put his spacecraft on the surface of Mars 2018. That's the plan. We'll see how it goes. Dick, he's got another deal coming up with NASA. Nothing signed yet. Let me drop it. It'll of course be after 2020. 2020 rover that NASA sent up. Yeah, that's the next window. Similar to Curiosity, is one of the things it's going to do is it's going to do core boring instead of just like taking shavings off of rocks. This thing's going to core bore into the ground, and it's going to take all these samples, up to 20 samples, I think, and it's going to store it on the rover itself, on the 2020 rover. By the way, they haven't given the 2020 rover a name yet. So at some point, Elon Musk and SpaceX will probably have a deal. Nothing's written in stone yet with NASA to send a similar rocket to this that he plans on sending on to Mars in 2018. This Red Dragon plans on eventually landing it near the new rover that's going up, 2020 rover. Let me drop it. Having the rover drive over to the Dragon that just landed, and have some kind of robotic arm system, either on Red Dragon or on the rover, somehow get the samples into a rocket that's going to be inside of Red Dragon, actually inside, and then the top of Red Dragon will open up, and out comes this rocket going to shoot up into Mars orbit, and eventually, I guess, link up with another rocket going around Mars. That'll, do a trans-Earth injection, and then send it back all the way to Earth with the samples that the 2020 NASA rover collected. These are all outrageous plans, but they're on the drawing board. Back to you, Dick. K2RIWWSLM.
When it comes to the first crewable piece of hardware that he's going to send to the surface of Mars, and I heard you in the beginning, it sounded like you said 2018, and now you repeated it. My goodness, that sounds ambitious. Wow. And why send a crewable piece of hardware to the surface of Mars when real men are going there? It's going to be a large number of years downrange, if at all. And one of the things that I think I said it already about the movie The Martian, they really didn't show you the average temperature. The average temperature there is extremely cold. Of all the power coming out of the nuclear power generators on Curiosity, isn't a high percentage of that power on the average day heating up individual experiments to keep them from freezing? Batteries and cameras and whatever. I think there's a significant thermal flow of the heat being given off by the radioactive thermal generator to keep various portions of that spacecraft warm. Because I think there are times when the temperature goes to numbers like minus 150 degrees. Isn't that sort of true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, the temperatures drop, and it, of course, it gets worse in the winter time. And their winter time is twice as long as our winter time, so the electronics are all scented. A lot of the electronics are scented. The sensitive stuff is centralized. They actually call it a web, a warm electronic box, that was developed